Well, for kind of a meditative beginning, I'm going to read from a part of the Gospel of Truth that we will not be discussing later, but it's one of those parts of a newly discovered text that has gotten to be quite the favorite in public ways. So, say then from the heart that you are the perfect day, and within you dwells the light that never ends. Speak of the truth with those who seek it, and of knowledge with those who have sinned through their transgressions. Strengthen the feet of those who stumble, and stretch your hands to those who are weak. Feed those who are hungry, and give rest to the weary. Raise those who wish to arise, and awaken those who sleep. For you are all understanding drawn forth. If strength does these things, strength becomes stronger. All right, so two passages this afternoon, and again, what we're working on is try to sort of give us a breadth of texts that are playing with creation and destruction. So this morning we looked at the Gospel of John and saw the way it really showed both creation and destruction in the story of the Johannine Jesus. Yesterday we got the Genesis 1 passage, and then the passages around light and creation from the Gospel of Thomas. So let's start within the Bible proper, and then we'll go to the Gospel of Truth later in the hour. But let's look at Proverbs, and I'd like us to look at Proverbs 8. And then we'll read verses 22 to 31, Proverbs 8, 22 to 31. This would be, if you can't find Proverbs, don't be ashamed. And if you can't find chapter 8, it's kind of messy to get there. 8, 22 to 31. Before we read this, just a little bit about the text of Proverbs. Proverbs, it reminds me often, the book of Proverbs reminds me of my grandmother on her bad days. It's one somewhat trite or somewhat wise little saying after another. You know, those things that our grandmothers sort of knitted or something. Well, this is, to a certain extent, just a lot of one-liners, some of which seem a little bit shallow and some of which seem wise. It looks like chapters 10 to the end, 32 of Proverbs, are just collections of these one sentence sayings from all different people. There's a chapter and a half that's from Egypt, interestingly enough. So a lot of collections of wise sayings, and really short wise sayings, that is a proverb. Then the first nine chapters are more or less not that at all. And they seem to be perhaps an introduction to all of these collections of one-liners. In chapters 1 to 9, it's more of a meditation on what wisdom is. And we can talk about that some as we go along. But so this is chapters 1 to 9 might be more sermon-like, poetic, or
philosophical or theological, in that they take on the larger question of what wisdom is. What the passage, one of the funny things that happens in chapters 1 to 9 of Proverbs is there appears a figure, a divine figure, who is called wisdom. So, in other words, wisdom is actually not just a quality, but a divine person. One might say it's the personification, the divine personification of the quality of wisdom. We'll see. We're going to just look at one part of that. But it seems like it is a, I would want to say that probably this is in a time period, which is in when Israel is also under foreign control by an empire or two, that it is a new kind of theology for Israel. Israel has now resigned that it will never be free. There were 5 centuries of empires that controlled Israel after the exile, and basically hardly any time in which Israel ruled itself. This is probably a time in which Israel has basically given up on what we might call covenantal theology. Covenantal theology is that larger picture of Israel's relationship to God in its kingdom and pre-kingdom time, in which the deal was, God says to Israel, I will take care of you if you obey my commandments. If you follow me, I'll take care of you. The problem with covenant theology in, say, the 3rd or 4th century, after you've been ruled by 3 different empires for more than 200 years, is it's fairly clear God is not taking care of you as a country. You actually will probably, you've now probably as a people said, so God said, I'm going to take care of you, meaning you're going to be my nation. And you haven't been God's nation for at least 200 years now. So in this, these first 9 chapters of Proverbs, it looks like they're rethinking who God is. And this is a much, it's not a nation-centered theology at all. Here, God is interested in the whole world, very interested in the world of nature and experience. So, for instance, in these first 9 chapters of Proverbs, the author never says, now make sure and go to the temple. Or never says, make sure and read scripture. This is scripture that does not recommend scripture. Rather, the main impulse is to say, watch experience. Be in experience, and there in your experience, you will meet God. So this is, yesterday we did one of the 2 creation narratives of the world in Genesis. This is the 3rd creation narrative in the Hebrew scripture. On Tuesday, we're going to do the 4th. Those of us who are still here on Tuesday. So anyway, now let's just have somebody read a couple of verses and stop, and then someone else will start again. If someone would start at 22, verse 22 of chapter 8.
The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of long ago. Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth.
Anyone else?
When there were no depths, I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills I was brought forth, when he had not yet made earth and fields. are the world's first bits of soil.
When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When he established the fountains of the deep.
When he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master worker, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the human race.
That's it. Thank you. All right. So some of you read this before, right? And so how many of you know this version of the creation? What? She wrote a book about it. Actually, Susan and I wrote...
Of course you did.
Susan and I wrote two books on the figure of wisdom. And were called out for heresy by writing both of them, I think. We were exonerated. Yes, Christy.
Is wisdom the I here is wisdom?
This is wisdom, yeah.
And I seem to recall that's a feminine word.
Mm-hmm.
It is. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, if you would go back forward or behind or after this particular passage, she will speak specifically as a feminine figure.
Okay. But in this particular passage, whatever the gender, it doesn't really matter to the point.
Well, see, it probably does. We'll look at that in a minute. But just general observations about this little story?
I mean, just looking at the, like in my copy here, 30, like a master worker, but the other option that's given is a little child.
Yeah, we'll have to see that. And yeah, you all should notice that. Point that out again.
Verse 30. Yeah. So then I was beside him like a master worker, but then here another reading is, then I was beside him like a little child.
Yeah. And we'll look at that a little bit later too. But both of those translations are really good, and of course really different, right? Because what is she doing here? She is helping God create the world. So there she would be the master worker. On the other hand, she's playfully doing everything. So she's delighting and playing, so that would be like a little child. So I don't much care how that translation ends up, because both sort of show deeper aspects of the person herself. Yes, Christy.
Was the Gospel of John inspired by this passage?
Oh, aren't you good? Yes, well, see, this morning I was tempted to go down that path, but this is what you'll see if you read more of Proverbs 1-9. Wisdom is so full of herself. She is proud of herself. She rules over everyone. She speaks endlessly about how great she is. And that's the way Jesus talks in the Gospel of John.
I am.
I mean, I am this, I am that. Yeah. God and I are really tight. I'm really divine. All of those. And so actually what we think is that the writer of the Gospel of John gave Jesus wisdom's personality. And lots of things about wisdom and Jesus in the New Testament also. So very, very much Jovenite.
Or was Jesus' wisdom. And then just when he became earthly, he had to be male or female, so then he was male. Maybe he was wisdom all along.
Yeah. Well, and this, look at what we what you see here is very much like in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This actually, so John then is almost certainly taking right from this passage, which has a picture of wisdom herself with God in the beginning.
What strikes me about this from this morning is when I read this passage, it's very active. It's like all sorts of things going on, whipping up things and clouds and stirring pots of wonderment or whatever is yeah. going on. And the same way that John was portraying Jesus as a let's head into the fray kind of Jesus.
But here, what's being, well, of course, and this is also the same as we saw this morning, of course, John 1 says the Word, which is almost exactly like wisdom, was how everything got created. And here, she is before everything. She by the way, that first verb, the Lord... I have the Lord created me. Is that what you all have?
Yeah. And brought me forth.
Yeah, okay. So actually, and which translation is that, Susan?
It's the NIV.
Oh, it's the NIV. Good for the NIV. The Lord brought me forth is probably nearer the Hebrew. In other words, the Hebrew is ambiguous as to whether God created her. Or it's almost like God found her in the way that the Hebrew reads. So
there's an alternative here. It says the Lord possessed me at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, that's all in the Hebrew itself. So yeah,
there's
more.
There's also a variant reading that says, so the Lord created me as the beginning. Mm-hmm. Is a possibility mm-hmm. in the NRSV.
That is, and that actually does work also yeah. in the Hebrew as well. So, in other words, very much like what we were saying this morning, she is divine, but it's kind of like, as we were talking about Jesus and John, she's divine junior. Or, I mean, she's not like the super divine. She is a divine partner. Which, of course, gets us to the feminine, right? So the picture is a female and a male divinity creating together. Heard that story before, haven't we? In other words, this is sort of like mommy and daddy, God, creating the world. And having a lot of fun, by the way, since there's so much joy in what goes on here. I have to say that works out just a little bit too neatly. Because if you look at the Hebrew, and especially John John or Hans, who were saying, noticing this variation of she is like a master worker or like a little child. So there are a lot of models of divinity in the Near East where it's God and daughter producing creation. That makes us all a little bit more nervous. In other words, this is a pairing of the daughter and the father. It could be. It's either father and mother or father and daughter. For me, a little scarier to think about, but that's just what is there in the Near East. So, could be mother, father, or something else.
Part of me really yearns for the feminine to be involved in the creation process, but correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, a lot of the verbs
are attached to the Yahweh more than...
Yeah.
I mean, there's... seems like there's this creation story, and for the most part, it's Yahweh that's doing all the creating.
Yeah.
Then there's the refrain, certainly, oh, and I was there too. I guess then that maybe could be looked at a couple different ways.
No, Kent, you're right on. That's right what we needed to see next. So this is really also, it's God Senior and God Junior in that way too. That is, this is a divinity that is not the top one. And at the same time, it's quite interesting. What does she do? You notice what the main thing she does? She plays. She delights. So what's really interesting there, of course, is what we know about creation. Or rather, what we know about creating. Those folks who do creating will always say, first thing to do is mess around. First thing to do is be playful. So in other words, this is almost certainly a picture of ongoing creation, ongoing creating, in that her role is, Kent, there I think it's very specific. It is somewhat second place, but this text knows that playfulness and delighting is completely at the heart of creating.
The one on the six a little bit, or is she the Sabbath to the...
Sort of, but I would say mostly it's that there is an imaginative quality and a playful quality about making things. But yes, also I think there's some of the Sabbath in it as well. You'd have to be doing, you'd have to be probably... imagining a lot on the Sabbath, or playing a game on the Sabbath, or something like that. Your observations are really right on with this, and you have been noticing things, other things to notice.
Well, 23 just says, I was there at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I was set up, which is kind of a strange way. But, so it wasn't, God did this, here I came along. It was, I was there in the beginning.
Yeah,
I don't know what the significance of that
right.
is. But
she really is, and this is very interesting also with what you're saying, Ken. She is the voice of this passage. But it does, in her voice, she is somewhat subservient. But here she's insisting, I wasn't there when it didn't matter anymore. I was there before anything happened. But then Kent is right, but then it's described as, I was there when he did this, and when he did that, and all along I was just playing. I would want to say that this text is wanting to say this person is really important. She is so much in chapters 1-9 of Proverbs that she takes up all of the airspace. Basically, God Senior or God He hardly ever. Comes to the fore in the first 9 chapters is almost all about her. So much, and most scholars think that's why chapter one, verse 2 of Proverbs is kind of defensive. I want to say, notice what that says. It's verse 7 the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That mentions the Lord, but what this is really saying, I think, is we're not forgetting the Lord, even though we're not going to talk a lot about wisdom, we're not forgetting him, and he's in charge. But then they go on to talk basically only of her.
So it's like it sets this, it says, okay, God, one, senior, whatever we're going to call, you know, yes, the God is the Lord.
Right.
Yahweh is the Lord. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's set that aside and then let's
move on. Now I'm going to tell you what's important about knowing God.
Right.
And so I would want to say back to chapter 8, 22 to 31, what I noticed is that it's the natural creation that is described. In other words, this is all about mountains and streams and hills, the soil and the earth and the fields, the sky. So this is a very nature-centered creation.
And the last line, it says, in delighting in the human race. So the human race wasn't part of the creation stuff here.
That's, in other words, yeah, this doesn't tell us.
Mm-mm.
Wait a minute, where did you do that?
Yeah. Was that before the mountains or after the streams?
Because there's not even any animals. There's nothing really alive, is there?
It's all landscape, isn't it?
Yeah, geology and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Until verse 31. Rejoicing right. is in his inhabited world and delighting in the human race.
Yeah, so it's not a complete description of the creation. It's more of a mood piece. It tells us who the creators are, and what they're like.
Well, and it does seem to say that the non-alive world came first.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah.
Before.
Although I'm wondering whether it's interested in the first and second. It doesn't seem, I mean, the fact that it just, as you said, by and by mentions humans at the end.
Yeah, kind of like an afterthought.
Yeah.
Something new.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to know we're an afterthought.
Sometimes afterthoughts are the best things.
Do we have a sense of timeline? Would this author have been, you know, have another creation narrative in mind, or?
I don't think this is, I don't think so. No, I think this is, because there's a lot about her before this and after this, and there, it's really interested in describing who she is, what she does, and then there's just this little snapshot of her at the beginning. And what she's really interested in the other descriptions is how she's taking care of the world and how she wants people to pay attention to her. Again, very much like Jesus in John. Yes, Kristen.
So was this period of time bringing in this, was it influenced a lot by the other cultures who had taken them over, that it's not a monotheistic theology so much anymore? I mean, it's kind of a compromiser, because it does seem like a separate entity.
Yeah.
Is that influenced by the cultures around?
Well, let's think a little bit about this, and here I'm going to just do some referring to other scriptures about her. So some of you know the Wisdom of Solomon and Ecclesiasticus, or sometimes called Ben Sirach. Those are in the Catholic and Episcopalian Bible, but not in the Protestant Bible. In other words, this is part of what we call the Septuagint. So the Protestant Bibles don't read Wisdom of Solomon or Ecclesiasticus, but they are accepted by Catholics and Episcopalians. And there she is also described a lot. She takes up a lot of those two books as well. So yes, for sure. Now, let's say this is written in the 3rd or 4th century BCE, which is kind of a general, and this is again after Israel's been decimated by all the empires and they're taking over, no more Israel nation. So that means that Israel knows a lot more about a lot of other nations. So that's quite clear. The second thing is this figure of wisdom is directly derivative of two goddesses in Egypt. The goddess Maat, M-A-A-T, and less directly Isis. So these are two female deities of Egypt, and both and Isis becomes very popular in the time of Jesus as throughout the Mediterranean. So yes, a lot of that, but probably mostly this is a theological move away from God is in charge of Israel to God is in charge. This is a God who loves the whole world. So this is the emphasis is, we actually want to shift the way we understand God from the person who takes care of Israel to the person who takes care of the world. And that means that, therefore, what you want to do is be aware of the world. So wisdom gives you wisdom. In other words, wisdom helps you know about the world. So basically here it is, this kind of God teaches you about the world and lets you know that she likes the world. It is true that in the late time before the Common Era, that you have multiple gods, not like polytheism so much, but this kind of middle ranking of God that is pretty important, but not the supreme, that has divine powers, and in this case, loves divine powers and participates in the creation of the world. Other questions and thoughts about that? Anything I should be saying, Susan, that I haven't yet? Okay. All right, so I think I would want to say two things about creation and destruction. First of all, this now deepens our palette of the biblical picture of creation. So we've now got a good three kinds of pictures of how creation gets done in John 1, in Genesis 1. What we know, of course, is John 1 is borrowing from this. So John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, is just a version of Proverbs 8. With a little bit different terminology, right? It was the Word rather than wisdom. But those are pretty close in terms of concept. So this, first of all, just if we're interested in creation and destruction, this is just making a broader biblical palette. What we haven't looked at, by the way, is the second story in Genesis, the Adam and Eve story, which is different than the seven-day story. We'll get to that a little bit later in the week. The second thing I would want to suggest about this is that this is like we saw in Jesus, the Word, this morning in John. This is a divine figure who isn't completely all-powerful. This is a divine figure who can't take care of everything. She can create, or alongside of someone, she can create. And this makes her somewhat vulnerable as a creating power. Not unlike what we saw this morning with John's Jesus, who has to die. John's Jesus is the creative Word, but God crucified. And then lived on. So I'm very interested in this creative divine power or character whose relationship to destruction does not overwhelm destruction, can't stop destruction sometimes. So two things that I just think this is a great story to know is there, because it makes our flex and our ability to understand creativity in the Bible much more broadly. But I also think that it's kind of helpful for us to notice that, as in our time, when we feel sometimes God may not be able to protect us from destruction and difficulty, this is a winsome figure. John, you want to say
something? Yeah, and so this comes out of Israel's experience of, hey, God didn't do what God said that he was going to do.
Right.
And so there are times, and so it's an acknowledgement of, yes, death still happens, destruction still happens.
Empire still happens.
Yeah, and what?
Empire still happens,
yes. And that are going to roll through us, because we got a bad place. We're living in a rotten place.
Right. I mean,
every empire wants to go through right where Israel lives.
Right.
Yeah.
Wonderful insight there that expands her winsomeness but not all powerfulness. Again, I want to say that there's a lot of room for us to begin thinking in the difficult times that we and our world are in, for us to notice divinity doesn't have to be always almighty. Divinity can be good, helpful, creative, but maybe not in complete control. I think the Christian message from the very beginning started playing with that. In other words, said, how about a crucified God? Mm-hmm.
Are you drawing from John when you talk like that? Or from
I'm actually drawing from, we worked on John this morning in that mm-hmm. regard. But no, I mean, Paul.
I wasn't seeing it in the passage in Proverbs.
No, it is not.
Okay.
But what I am saying is that this whole text of Proverbs is written in a time mm-hmm. In which you got to take into fact that sometimes your God doesn't have all the options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see that certainly for wisdom in the passage mm-hmm. in Proverbs, but other than that, God looks pretty strong here. He even sets the limits to the sea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
my worry off my list.
Well, but the thing is that I want to say, Proverbs is more interested in you having a relationship with her mm-hmm. than him.
Yeah.
Now she gets way more territory and description than he does. So, and that's, I just am very interested in the the ways of our time that we, in which we have so much falling apart, that you have a book in the Bible that actually is more interested in the not quite all-powerful God than the all-powerful God.
Yeah.
Or one could say, Yahweh was saying that Yahweh never said that Yahweh was going to take care of the whole world. Yahweh was just going to take care of Israel. And that was problematic as well. So I want to we'll be coming back to her tomorrow a bit, but I want to just give us yet another thing on our palate, and that's the gospel of truth. And this isn't quite as long, but I want to say just a little bit about the gospel of truth. Again, the gospel of truth was in that same, and this is, we'll get to reading in just a minute. The gospel of truth is in that same jar we described yesterday, the Nag Hammadi jar discovered in 1945, that had 52 unknown, previously un, well, not quite unknown, but unpossessed books from the earliest Christ movement. And we talked about the Gospel of Thomas yesterday. This is the Gospel of Truth. There's several other Gospels in that, but a lot of other kinds of texts, that we'll, some of which we'll look at in coming lessons. So the Gospel of Truth, like as we said this morning with probably the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Luke, was written in the second century. So this is a good four or five generations after Jesus. And probably written around the time that we're now putting the Gospel of Luke, 120s or so.
Oh, that's new.
That's last 10 to 20 years, people have been saying, okay, been watching.
It's new for me.
Yeah.
Let's push John, let's push Luke further out instead of
Luke. Looks like it's the last of the four canonicals.
Interesting.
It's making so much more sense when you read Luke as a second century document than as a first. And it shows you all of the things that Luke has in it would make so much more sense in the second century. Gospel of Truth, it doesn't have an author. Well, that's actually true, of course, of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We don't know who wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but we don't know who wrote the Gospel of Truth. Either the Gospel of Truth is kind of like a long sermon. It also does not have a story. It is just jam-packed with Jesus. Got a lot of stuff we know about Jesus and a lot of stuff we don't know about Jesus until the Gospel of Truth comes along. The Gospel of Truth is by far, I would want to say, the most joyous and sensuous product of the first 200 years of the Christ movements. It is just full of lush joy all over the place. One of my favorite parts of it is its description of the relationship between people and God. It says that the relationship between people and God is that humans are God's fragrance. Mm. I mean, can you think of a more beautiful picture of who we are? So we are God's fragrance. So we are the way people get to smell God. So there's just lushness all over the Gospel of Truth. And I want us to read it's chapter 10. I want us to read its description of wisdom. And this is the Father's word on wisdom herself. And
let's have, I'll read those first six verses. His wisdom meditates on the word, and his teaching speaks it. His knowledge reveals it, and his patience is a crown upon it. His joy is in harmony with it, and his glory has exalted it. His manner has revealed it, and his rest has received it. His love made a body for it, and his trust has embraced it. In this way, the word of the Father walks in creation as the fruit of his heart and the face of his love. It bears all things and chooses all things, and it receives the face of all things and purifies them, bringing them back to the Father, to the Mother, Jesus of boundless sweetness. See what I mean? It's just like, could you be a little less positive and lush about anything? It's just, who is this lushness about creation and God over the reader? And this is about wisdom and the Word and all of the ways that God's enlivened Word happens in the lives of people and in the world. For me, my favorite is verse 4. His love made a body for word, for his word, and his trust embraced it. Or the next one, in this way, the word of the Father walks in creation as the fruit of his heart and the face of his love.
It's talking about wisdom or Jesus?
Yes.
Yes.
Thanks.
Is it the word is Jesus?
Yes.
But it's saying wisdom meditates on the word. So wisdom, is wisdom a separate person, entity from the word?
I think it wants to mess with you on that. I think sometimes Jesus' wisdom and sometimes Jesus' word in the Gospel of Truth. In this case, it feels to me like Jesus is more the word than wisdom. So, in other words, in other places in the Gospel of Truth, Jesus is described as God's presence in the world. And Jesus teaches. I probably don't have enough time to give you this other really beautiful passage of Jesus' teacher. But let's also notice, relative to this portrait of wisdom and God and we get to Jesus in the sixth verse. So I can't make sense exactly of this. So it bears all things and chooses all things, and it receives the face of all things and purifies them. Now, I guess this is the next thing, the next one that we need Christie's parsing on this. Bringing them back to the Father, to the Mother. And by the way, I'm not making this up in my translation. This is right there in the Coptic. Bringing them back to the Father, to the Mother. Who is the Mother?
Wisdom?
No! Well, Jesus of boundless sweetness. That's, in other words, this description of the Mother is Jesus of boundless sweetness. So I would want to say that sounds more like wisdom. I mean, trying to get at both of your questions. But obviously, I think this approach is, it just floods you with positive imagery of the experience of the divine. And that Jesus is over and over again the one who makes the lush, full, and rich experience of God possible. I mean, so remember, this is the same author that says we are God's perfume, or God's fragrance. Here, we know God's word through
the mother who is Jesus of boundless sweetness. Now, it's of course not at all unusual that Jesus is called a divine female person. Paul calls Jesus wisdom and goes on to refer back to Proverbs. So the kind of the gender-bended character of Jesus is in John and is in Paul and in a number of these new places we saw this morning how the Gospel of Thomas is compared to wisdom herself as well. So let me read one more piece from the Gospel of Truth. I was too cheap to I wanted this handout to be on just back in front. So I the beginning on this on the other side, I've got like a sentence to read you that then picks up. I'm going to read this first sentence and then ask you all to in turn or whoever wants to read the rest of it. So this begins, "This is the way of those who hold something of the immeasurable greatness from above." Now somebody else.
Which verse was that?
That's
one.
That was one.
Two. Different side.
Oh, okay.
"This is the way of those who hold something of the immeasurable greatness from above.
They stretch toward the full one alone, who is a mother for them.
They do not descend into Hades, nor do they have envy or groaning. They do not have death within themselves, but they rest in the one who rests.
They are not troubled or twisted around the truth, but they are truth. And the Father is within them, and they are in the Father. They are full and undivided from the one who is truly good.
They need nothing at all, but they are at rest, fresh in spirit, and will listen to their root. They will concern themselves with those things in which they will find their root and not suffer loss to their souls. This is the place of the blessed. This is their place."
You can stop there. Here also, this is the conclusion, as you can see, of the Gospel of Truth, and this is just an ode to what happens when one is at one with God. And what I want to say is that the language is so experiential. As it goes through. And again, you can see this is so full of goodness and truth and happiness that I sometimes, when I'm reading the Gospel of Truth, I have to say, could you just show me a little bit more tension in this? Because this is all so full of comfort and goodness and sweetness and light. And as you can see, here, the picture of God's creativity is really cross-gendered. I mean, this is both interested in the Father and the Mother and Jesus of immeasurable sweetness. So it's not going in, this really mixes up into much more I would say inscrutable mixes of God the Father and Mother than even Proverbs does. Proverbs has the female and the male divine figure together, but they're acting kind of like males and females act together as they create. Here it seems like the Father and Mother and Jesus all kind of flow into each other. Thoughts or questions about this picture of creativity and creation?
Yes, Christine.
What, I'm curious that the, I haven't read the books. It has all 42 of these books from the jar, or this?
You can find all 52 in, it's called the Nag Hammadi Library. The work I've done is adds 10 of them to the regular New Testament.
Okay, so the jar itself, is it coming from a different tradition than Paul possibly or something? Or is that in there? Or, it just seems like it makes sense to me, but on the other hand, it's not what I read, what I learned in
confirmation.
I was Presbyterian, but we looked at a lot of Paul. It just doesn't sound like Paul to me.
It's okay.
yeah. Well, but the question still, where in the world does this come from?
So is it maybe from a dip? I mean, I know Peter and Paul didn't like each other, which that made. So did this come from Peter or some other person? I mean, there must have been a lot of different branches at the time.
Yeah.
Different prophets happened to go out.
So important.
Or not prophets, messengers, whatever.
So important. And I have to say that your question is too good for me. I don't know it all. I mean, really don't know how to answer it. But it's such a good question. Let me stay with the question. So it turns out that the 52 books, and again, there are about 100 more discovered in the last 150 years. So there's a lot more than that jar. But it turns out that in that jar is not at all unified in its content. So it has a lot of different perspectives. So remember the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas is not near as sweet as the Gospel of Truth. And the Gospel of Thomas has all these pithy little sayings, not long poetic pictures of God and Jesus. There are a number of the books in the Nag Hammadi jar that actually love Paul and are in the Pauline tradition as well. So I think I want to say that, it turns out that this is not a jar that had one kind of direction. But that's the bigger message, of course, that we're learning about the early Christ movements themselves all over, that there is amazing variety. As I've been working on this material, I'm more and more, since the New Testament itself was late, not until the fourth century at least, and probably the fifth century, that the New Testament even comes into being. I think that the New Testament was put together in part because it was diverse, not because it was party line. So for instance, Jesus in Mark is way different than Jesus in John. Jesus in Matthew is really Jewish. Jesus in Luke is hardly Jewish. So in other words, I think myself that one of the things that whoever put, we don't quite know who put the New Testament together, right? But whoever kind of sheltered it into existence liked to have differences rather than agreement. And I would say that the same is evident in the Nag Hammadi jar. I think the other thing to say, Christy, about your excellent question is, get back to me in 25 years, or that is, get back to my students in 25 years. I'll be dead. I'm 70 almost. In other words, we're just at the beginning of trying to come to terms with, first, the diversity of the New Testament. See,
when doctrine went at the New Testament, it wanted to unify perspective. And so it just left out stuff in the New Testament that wasn't there. So for instance, most of the New Testament doesn't seem to know about either the Trinity or the Virgin Birth.
Paul never mentions it.
Paul, yeah. And so in other words, that didn't mean that there was a big disagreement about it. It just means when doctrine wants to make things clear, it doesn't seem to have the same agenda as Scripture, which likes to be playful and multi-valent and diverse. That seems a little less responsible than I'd like to be. In other words, because I think your question still is valid. Where do these come from and how do they fit together? Or how do they fit side by side? Or when are they in tension with one another? And for the gospel of truth, I feel like we are not far enough along to know exactly where it's coming from. The people who discovered, I'm over time, I'll say just one thing. People who discovered Nag Hammadi and the first two generations that started studying that were so freaked out that you had a whole bunch of new materials that they immediately created a heretical category for it. And that was called Gnosticism. Turns out the Gnosticism is very poor scholarship. And the scholars argued about what Gnosticism is. But the key thing is that they said it's bad. Only in the last 40 or 50 years have people said to the first two generations that discovered Nag Hammadi and wrote about it, we think that your categories were much too negative. And so the last two generations have been saying, we better read this more carefully. So that's a half answer and not good enough. And our time's up. Thank you.